Awesome. So we've got Riley Williams here out of Dallas, Texas, who's got such a fascinating story. He was a career lawyer who then realized a little bit in, didn't want to be a lawyer after you incurred all those costs for law school, decided to be an entrepreneur and investor. Riley, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. Great to be here. Longtime listener.
Awesome. Thanks, man. So a couple things. You've had kind of a cool transition from being a lawyer to an entrepreneur investor. And most recently, you've actually had some really cool, successful exits in the trampoline park space and the escape room space. Before we jump into those exits, I think talking about exits is really, really valuable when it comes to, you know, buying and selling. You can just kind of see how deals are structured and how people find deals and everything. Walk us through your path and why you're not an attorney anymore.
grew up in a family of attorneys. I have four attorneys in my immediate family between my dad and my brothers and sisters, and I'm the youngest. So I was kind of following in the family path. And so I went to great law school, got into the big law firm, was basically winning under most lawyers' metrics in terms of job and salary and all that. And by the time I got to my law firm and I was there and I looked around, there was just no one that was around me that I could see myself wanting to be like when I grew up. There are these law firm partners and these big law associates, and I didn't find any of them to be inspiring. So real fast, as a lawyer, I knew that I wanted to get out and do my own thing. And a couple months in, there was this article on MarketWatch called the unbelievably lucrative business of escape rooms. And so I read the article, and there were escape rooms that were just popping up close to my law offices. And back then, and probably still today, you could go on to the escape room's website and see how many bookings they had for that day. And so it was pretty easy to track what revenue that they were doing. And so I started looking at their revenue every single day. While I got to my law firm job, the first thing I did before I did any client work was look at what the escape rooms had done the day before and were going to do that same day. And it kind of proved out their revenue model. Looked like these places were doing a lot of money, $1 million, $1.5 million type numbers on not that much cost from a rent and a build out perspective. And so that kind of proved out the model for me that it could be a viable exit. And my brother found this space in Utah that made sense for us to go for it. So my brother, I had a buddy from KPMG that also quit his job, and I quit my law firm job, and we all left together in June of 16 to start Alcatraz Escape Games, which had two locations in Utah, and then there's another two, and there's one in Dallas and one in Arizona. And we operated that for 4 years and just recently sold it a couple months ago, sold our two Utah locations. And then we also own Airborne Trampoline Park, Labyrinth Reality Games, Golden Axe Throwing. So we are pretty big in the retail entertainment space. We started transitioning out of escape rooms, and you know, we still have trampoline parks and a few other retail concepts still.
That's awesome, man. That's so fascinating. Thanks for kind of giving us that background. The retail entertainment space is so interesting. And the first time I went to a trampoline park over a decade ago, I thought to myself, I want to own a bunch of these things. And so I'm living vicariously through you. You have four other lawyers in your family, so I'd imagine Thanksgiving has got to just be absolutely nuts for you.
Yeah, it's brutal. And they all thought that I was crazy to leave my good law firm job to basically start. They always called it carnival houses. They thought I was going to be like a three-ring circus leader or something. So it was definitely not the popular decision within the family for me to do it, but it's ultimately what I wanted to do, and it's worked out thus far.
They're probably asking you how they can get in now. So, jokes on everybody who doesn't believe on you, Riley. So, it's funny. We have a very similar path. I've done that same thing. I call it the hall check, when you're sitting in your cubicle or sitting in your office and you look down the hall and you're like, I don't know if I'd really want to switch shoes with anybody down this hallway. Am I in the right place? You know? And so, takes so much guts to be able to do that. And it's really, really hard, especially the years that you've invested in. And, you know, it sounds like you grew up knowing you were going to be an attorney, and it just takes guts to do that. And it's a bold, courageous move. And it's awesome that it's even paid off so fast. A lot of times it doesn't pay off that long. And the other thing I thought was really, really interesting is how you did research within the space. So you could jump on not necessarily like a competitor, but like a different, like a similar business. And just based on their bookings, you just try to book through their site. You could tell, hey, how booked is this? And I've actually done that with like Airbnb and being like within the, you know, if I want to, you know, get a place in Jackson Hole or outside in Idaho, on the other side of the Tetons, it's like, well, I just jump in and all I do is check the listings and how often they're booked. And that way I can get an idea of like, well, you know, there's, you know, most of these are not booked. But I think that's a fascinating way to actually do some business research before you jump into an industry.
Yeah, I the way that my brain works, I can once I see how a model works, I can execute it in my own way. And so most of the add-ons that we've done in entertainment, be it trampoline parks or Labyrinth Reality Games or Golden Axe, those were all derivative decisions based on the fact that somebody else had already answered the demand question, that demand existed. And if we, found our niche in the space, that people would come, and that wouldn't really be a question. And so in the escape room business, I mean, you are looking at your direct competitors and seeing what they're doing, just because so much, and especially if you look at the broader startup world, so much in the broader startup world, the big question is there really demand for this product? And then is there product market fit? But the first chasm that you have to cross is, do people actually want this thing? And I'm not creative in that way. I could have never in a million years have come up with the idea of locking people in themed rooms and trying to have them solve a series of things to get out. But if you tell me that people want that and they're willing to pay X amount for it and there's sufficient demand for it, then I can figure out how to make that work. And so I do the same thing. I do it on Shopify stores. If I'm looking at a Shopify thing, I'll go on competitors and I'll, you know, if you click how many you want to buy, you can see how much inventory they're holding on separate SKUs. I have a bunch of different apps like storeleads.app, where you can look at competitors and, you know, get an idea of what they're doing, just to solve the demand question. Is demand there? And then you can move on to the product question. So that's what we did. Demand was there. And then our product innovation was, we wanted more actors in the space, more interactive. We thought that would be more fun. But that's how I always have to solve the demand question whenever I'm getting pitched a new startup from ground zero, or looking to invest in something that's been around longer, is just, do people even really want the thing that, like, we think that they do? And then how do we know that they do?
I love that. You kind of focus on the demand and work yourself backwards. So being in the retail entertainment space, how did you, you know, those are like, I've looked at, you know, trampoline parks, like I'd mentioned, those aren't necessarily the cheapest things to build out. And you're putting a lot of time and effort and build out into these spaces. You know, how did you fund that? And how did you build up the equity to be able to do that?
Yeah. Well, when we started Alcatraz, we put up $200,000 between the three partners that we all kind of had in cash. And that initial 200 grand got us to build our first two rooms. And then basically over time, we continued to reinvest the profits in the business and grew it to locations, just continuing to roll cash back. And so it started with a $200,000 investment, and that's kind of how it all got kicked off. And then as we kind of grew and expanded concepts, we ended up taking on more friends and family money so we could grow faster. And then in the last few parks that we've gotten private equity involved grow these last few parks. But that's kind of how we all got our jump start.
That's awesome. It's amazing what you can do with a few hundred grand and between a few people as that adds up, and you're kind of not cashing out the company immediately, but if you can roll those profits into the next location and the next location, or roll it back into more marketing, you're just investing back in that company. And it sounds like you're able to do that across multiple states, which is just awesome. So you've got these companies. It sounds like you've got some partners, you got some investors and stuff. What prompted you all to sell, other than, you know, sometimes it's nice just having something totally new?
So for Alcatraz, one of the partners that my partner that left his KPMG job, about 6 months before we sold, he decided that he was ready to take on something a little bit more stable. So he got a job doing a sales function that he was excited about, an opportunity that got him excited. In that time, I had also moved away. I had moved to Dallas to kind of grow our locations here. We felt like we had a product that was pretty comparable to Alcatraz and Labyrinth Reality Games. And so we felt like the prospect of us building more Alcatraz escape rooms was pretty unlikely, because we felt like Labyrinth had better unit economics and a better way to kind of innovate on the escape room business to the extent that we continued to grow more locations. And, you know, when you're operating a business for 4 or 5 years, you run into recurring problems, right, that are just kind of intrinsic in the business that you're in. And we all felt like, with me being in a different state, another partner kind of taking a different job, we felt like the energy and the momentum for Alcatraz on a going forward basis was not going to be driven by anyone that was really at the helm, and that it made sense to exit while the numbers were still reflective of, you know, forward progress. And that was, we just all kind of got interested in different things when we originally started, having three mouths at the table. You know, splitting that up on a monthly basis ends up, you know, the numbers don't always work as projected. And so it felt like a good time to clean up the ownership, get new ownership that was excited about the prospect of growing it, and kind of chase other different shiny objects.
So there's a question I get a lot, Riley, that is very in line with all that. And it's like, why would someone sell a perfectly good business? And I think you hit on a lot of different things. And there comes to a point where most businesses, they're going to have those recurring problems, and you have to either scale, and you know, you're going to invest so much back into the company to grow that to the next level that it's not interesting to you all, or maybe not even feasible. And the other thing is, people are just ready to move on, right? It sounds like you had three partners, everybody was kind of going a different direction. Energy and momentum is huge. And so what I see sometimes, businesses or business owners, they want to sell, but they wait too long, and they've waited for the energy and momentum to kind of go on the downhill, and then your multiple just gets hammered. And so you don't actually get what is out of there. So what you all did really, really well is notice that, hey, we are not the right people to take this from, say, 5 locations to 10 locations, or to continue this for the next decade. How do we move on right now? And it sounds like you all worked really well as partners, but you know, at some point, everybody does have different interests. And so it's really critical that you all saw that before it started to go down, because once the energy and momentum and someone's not kind of, you know, held accountable for all that, you're going to see those dip. And so you're able to do that beforehand.
Yeah. And I was always the partner that was adamant about selling. You know, we closed in June. We went under contract in November, so long before coronavirus. But I started actively listing the property. You know, I talked with a couple of business brokers. I didn't feel like any of them were going to be worth what they were going to charge. So I decided to list the business myself. I had done M&A transactions as a lawyer before, so I felt comfortable doing the transaction and talking with prospective buyers. So I was adamant about selling the business long before, and obviously coronavirus kind of vindicated that, because now I don't think that we would have been able to sell it. I started to project out what the business looked like in 2 or 3 years from now, and just where did it feel like the momentum was moving, and to the extent that it was, that the momentum needed to change, who was going to be the partner that was going to bring that energy to change that momentum. And it was clear to me that there wasn't any of the three of us that, you know, I wasn't going to move back to Utah and really get back into the weeds of the business. And so I wanted to sell on the high, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's a great example of, like, it's a perfectly good business. It's just not the right business for you and your partners anymore. And you all are moving in a different direction, and that's okay. I think that's the misconception that, hey, if the business is making money, why would anybody sell it? Well, you know, interests move on and you only have so much time and energy throughout the day. So you took an interesting approach. You have a background in M&A, and so you didn't hire a broker. What snags did you run into in the process? I guess you got, you know, the big COVID-19, right? What other snags did you run into in the process of going through these transactions?
You know, when you're selling a brick and mortar business, you always, a lot of it comes to leases and making sure that the leases match with the financing terms of a buyer. We had, you know, my partner that I bought out, he had the accounting background to run any financial data that these buyers needed. I could do a lot of the lease legal stuff. And so snag wise, other than coronavirus, you know, the big pressure cooker is making sure, from our end, it was making sure that we continued to have a narrative of growth even throughout coronavirus, and making sure that we were pulling all the levers that we could possibly pull to keep a growth narrative happening through the sale, you know. And we, because the natural inclination, once you get an offer and once it's down on paper, how much you're going to get paid, the natural inclination is just kind of move on to the next thing and hope that it all just kind of handles itself. And those are, I'd seen it enough from a lawyer's perspective, being under contract and things not going through. And so for us, it was just no rest until the money hits the accounts, and we have to continue to market hard, and we have to watch every single dollar that is going in and out of the business to make sure that it continues to align with the growth story that you know, the buyers felt like they were getting, and make sure that they were getting the business that they thought that they were getting.
Yeah, that's a very common theme, is people decide to sell their company and then check out, right? Well, this is even before you're under LOI, you're under contract or something. So it's very, very tricky to go down that path. You have to be kind of all in till the very last moment, till documents are signed. Because if you drop the ball at any given point, it's still in the seller's court. The buyer at any given point can kind of walk away, right? And so,
right.
And what I see too is, like, sellers, they wait too long. The energy momentum is already down in the business. It just is reflected. And over time, as that business is listed for longer and longer, or the due diligence period takes longer and longer, or a COVID-19 happens, then you run into all these things that all of a sudden you end up with this park and you've neglected it for 6 months. So that's really, really key that you've seen that before, decided when to sell it, and then pushed all the way through to the end to make it as buttoned up as if you were going to continue to run it for the next 5 or 10 years.
Yeah. And throughout the sale process, you know, as coronavirus hit and as things changed, the deal changed a little bit. There had to be a little bit of horse trading between the buyer and the seller. And to me, I think, you know, just in dealing with that process with my partners, I think that you can get yourself messed up, As the deal changed, it was important for us to continue to be reasonable and to not get too caught up in, oh, well, are they out negotiating us? Are they trying to just get to our bottom dollar? Should we walk from the deal? You can start playing the mind game instead of just looking at, it's still a good deal for us, even at these new numbers. And so let's continue to go forward, even though, you know, maybe they're out negotiating us, but at the end of the day, are we still happy with this? And let's move forward then.
That's an interesting perspective. I think when you're under contract, when there's new information, right, it's kind of the grounds of, like, well, we have this information. There's sort of this new negotiation process. It doesn't stop at any given point, especially when you have like you're in the middle of this pandemic trying to sell a retail entertainment business. It's you have to kind of go about it from a reasonable and logical standpoint. You can get very, very tied up in the emotions, and that's how deals blow up. And you guys were able to do that, right? That's just so fascinating. Because I don't think most people are able to do those types of things when you're dealing with lots of money, because it's so emotional. So congratulations on your sale. You've got a couple other ones that you're trying to sell right now. What's next for you now that you've sold part of your entertainment business? Is it more retail space in the entertainment area, or what's next for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm in the process of learning how to be actively patient and trying to not jump into the next thing. From law school, from college days, there always has to be an answer of like, what's the next thing you're going to do? And that's what got me, law school was always the answer, and then doing entertainment was the next answer. My new thing that I'm on is to just not have an answer to that question yet. And, as I continue, because my inclination is to not be patient and like go, and I can start four more businesses, and I'm looking at new businesses to buy. I try to look at, even in the buy and the sell process, as you're looking to buy a business, the question after you get past the economics, the real question ends up being, what are the problems that you're going to solve on a daily basis with this business? And are those problems that will bring you some semblance of joy or energy or feeling of accomplishment? And so I don't know what the final packaging looks like in terms of what I want to ultimately do next. And so I just try to ask myself on a daily basis, am I trending towards solving more problems that I enjoy solving? And if I focus on that, then it'll eventually work itself out. It's kind of like a Zen, like non-answer.
No, I actually like that, being actively patient. I think we jump into stuff too fast, especially if you're an entrepreneur. I've got like a dozen ideas. I'm going to try them out really quick. But you hit on such an important thing that I don't think is just applicable to buying a company or selling a company or building a company. It's kind of applicable to everything in life. And what you choose and what your desire is, it's like, what you're basically choosing the problems that you're going to solve, right? And are those problems ones that you want to solve? And are those going to make you who you want to be? And are those things you want to be doing, rather than, hey, like the numbers make sense, this looks like an exciting business, but then all of a sudden you realize, oh, I'm dealing with a bunch of minimum wage employees across 10 locations. Well, do you want to solve those types of problems? The answer could be yes, but it may not be yes. Whereas the money and the unit economics work, but do you really want to be doing that? So I have a ton of respect for you that you're able to kind of take a step back, Riley, figure out what that next step is and not rush into it, because you can be very, you basically have, I feel like, money doesn't bring happiness, but it, being poor doesn't make you happy either, but money can buy you freedom. And essentially what money can allow you to do right now, Riley, is take a step back, take some time to say, what do I really want to do? So you basically bought some time to say what's next and what sounds fun.
Yeah. And, after you sell a couple of businesses and you get some money in the bank account and you realize that not much has changed, and you realize that so much of your path, so much of those 4 years was predicated on the moment that ended up not feeling that much different than the moments prior to it. And so constantly persuading yourself that a certain type of problem, although sucky in solving it, will be worth it because of the monetary benefit at the backside. And it ends up not working that way. And before that, the question was always what gets me freedom? And the more interesting question that I'm starting to ask myself, and I think that's a perfectly appropriate question to ask. When I was at a law firm, the question is like, how do I just get out of this damn thing? The new question is not how can I have more freedom? It's what do I want to commit to? And what is the thing that committing to it and tying myself down to it will energize me? It's like the difference between being a single guy or girl going out and doing whatever you want, bachelor life versus like marriage and commitment and like what are you going to tie yourself down to, where you can get a lot more fulfillment. And at the very least, it's an interesting question. I don't know what it'll lead to, and I don't know if it'll be a question that'll be interesting. Yeah, at some point, you got to do something. I can't just meditate all day. but it's a good thought experiment, at least.
No, that's awesome. I really appreciate that. And it's fun to see people take a step back rather than rush into the next thing, be very methodical about it. And there's different stages. You mentioned, hey, when you're in your job, you're like, I just need to get out. I need an income. I need to move on to the next thing. There's all these different stages. And so now you've gotten out what you didn't want to do. And you went down an awesome path, learned a ton. And it's like, okay, cool. Now I have a little bit of time to figure out what the next thing is. So everybody's in a different stage. And there are stages where you're like, I just need to go make some money. And then the next stage is, okay, yeah, let's take a step back and figure out what that next thing is. So, Riley, I'm so excited to see where things go. To be totally open, my sister-in-law and her husband just moved out to Fort Worth for medical school. And I'm like, sweet. Now I have an excuse to go out and visit. So I'm going to hit you up and we're going to go to Taco Cabana when I go out to Dallas.
Yeah, bro. Let's do it. I'll show you a place that's a little bit better than Taco Cabana. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I just say that because that's where we would go in high school out in West Texas. So just fond memories, but I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll upgrade it. I'll upgrade you.
Yeah, there's probably way more there taco are. Places. All right, man. So where can people find you? Where can they figure out what you're up to and follow you?
Yeah, LinkedIn is easy. Raleigh Williams. I have a podcast, Raleigh G Audio Experience, that when I'm feeling it, I'll record. I've been a little bit spotty lately, but LinkedIn's easy. And Facebook as well, Raleigh Williams.
Awesome. We'll link to those in the show notes. Thanks so much, Raleigh. Appreciate it.
I'll talk to you later.